Hi, I'm Terry, Instagram's sassy sober mum. Welcome to my podcast, Sober Stories from Everyday People. Bringing you stories from people just like you and I, the aim of this podcast is to share our experiences with drinking and how we got and stayed successfully sober. Not sure if you know already, but I offer 6-week and 100-day coaching opportunities to work with me one-to-one each week. In these 50-minute sessions, I will be guided by your particular set of challenges and experiences and tailor a style of support that suits your life, your needs, but also covering many of the basics that you expect in sobriety. You will learn about why you drink, why it's hard to stop drinking, what you need to do to succeed, the science around cravings, poor sleep, managing your thoughts, and finally, powerful tools like reframing, taking back your power, implementing boundaries, and building self-confidence. In the 100 days coaching, you also get WhatsApp access with me directly for any urgent or general support outside of the sessions. Here's what Sarah says about the 100 days coaching with me. What have you gained from coaching with me?
So much. I can't even begin to tell you what an amazing journey this has been. I have gained insight. It's probably been the biggest thing, and how to cope, coping mechanisms, strategies. The biggest thing I've learned has been learning how to reframe, reframing situation, reframing what to do, you know, if those thoughts pop up. I did come to you obviously a little bit destroyed, or more than destroyed, and on the floor, but I knew that I had it in me to do it, and with your help and insights and strategies and what homework you gave me just made it so much easier and normalised it as well. If I had an issue with something, you were there.
It's so nice to hear that feedback, and it's just such a privilege to help people to feel supported on this journey and to see people flourish after the 100 days is finished is a really, really wonderful feeling. So if you're interested in working with me for 6 weeks or 100 days, please go to the website www.sassysobermum.com/coaching and you can send an inquiry from there, or just contact me on Instagram or send me an email, whatever suits you the best. I usually open up my diary once a month to take on a new 100-day client. So let me know and we can see if we can get you booked in. Okay, let's jump into the episode. Hello, and welcome to Sober Stories from Everyday People. Today, I'm going to be talking to Donna, and she's in, we practiced this, Donna, didn't we? She's in,
we did.
In Thurrall, which is about an hour from Sydney, New South Wales, Australia, for those of you that don't recognise those words. She is also 4 years, 3 months and 10 days sober. Thank you so much for, we were laughing, weren't we? Because it's nearly 9 o'clock your time, which in a sober world is like nearly late night. So thank you so much for waiting up.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks, Terry. Great to be here. Excited to have a chat with you all the way from Australia.
Yeah, amazing. Well, let's just jump straight in. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, and your life, and then we'll jump into your story.
Sure. So, yes, my name is Donna. I recently turned 57, and, yes, I've been sober for 4 years, 3 months and 10 days. I live with my husband, Shane, of 25 years, and we have a geriatric rescue dog called Zach. He's sleeping over there. So, yes, we live an hour south of Sydney by the beach. It's beautiful. We have like a massive mountain behind us and then the beach in front of us, and it's a lovely village in Thurrall. We're both originally from Melbourne, so this is where we've been for about 12 years and we love it. We don't have children, but like I said, we have our geriatric dog who's my little Benjamin Button baby. I'm currently between jobs. I was actually made redundant in June, which was a bit of a shock, but I'm trying to use it as an opportunity like anything these days. I've worked mainly in legal administration, assisting lawyers, and I've also dabbled a bit in business-to-business magazine writing. My most recent jobs have been with compensation law firms where the clients were adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse. So that's not for everyone. I might continue with that. I'll just see. So I'm enjoying having a bit of a break and being a bit selective with my job searches. My husband got off the hamster wheel of the big corporate high-powered, high-paying jobs some years ago. And so he does dog walking and pet sitting. So I'm helping a bit with him because he's quite busy at the moment. So it's nice to be outdoors, getting some fresh air and just sort of, I don't know, being a bit more mindful. I'm not having to worry about what's happening tomorrow. And, yeah, I'm just sort of having a bit of a relax. So it's good. And I've been working since I was 17. So, you know, that's 40 years. So maybe it's time to have a little break.
Yeah.
See what's next.
Definitely. And I think as well, when you are sober, that becomes more in the forefront, that kind of taking time for yourself and having a bit of balance in life, because we do just fall into work, don't we? And it's like bum, 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 bum.
Yeah, we do.
Every day. And, yeah, it sounds absolutely lovely, actually. And it's nice to be in that position as well where you can be choosy and not under loads of pressure to just be, like, straight back out working.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sounds really nice. I'm really looking forward to getting into the story because I'm sure there is a big story before all of this that kind of got you into this place. So take me back and talk to me about your life with alcohol. Big question.
Well, my parents weren't what I call drinkers. My mum hardly drank at all, if at all. You know, a champagne in front of her at a special occasion. She probably only had a few sips. My dad wasn't a big drinker either. We lived on a farm from when I was like 6 to 19. It was sort of, it's what suburbia is now, but it was on 200 acres and he worked on the farm a bit and he would come back and have a beer, a cold beer, and then he'd put a little teaspoon in the top of it because they were all long necks back then and they didn't have stubbies. And it would just sit there for goodness knows how long. So they weren't big drinkers, but we did have a bar in the house and they used to entertain a lot, so it was more for other people. One of my jobs was to, you know, with my chores, was to clean all the shelving, the glass shelving and the beautiful glasses and things. But it never occurred to me to try any of the alcohol. I was a pretty good kid and I just never thought about it. And I guess my childhood and teenage years were quite sort of controlled. I feel like I was closely monitored by my mum. And like I said, we were on a property, so I couldn't sort of go anywhere without being taken. I was the baby after two other older children, so it was like a 10 and a 14-year gap. Once I got my license, I was out of there because you're 18. In Australia, or in Melbourne anyway, you had to be 18 to get your license. So as soon as I got it, I was out in my car. So my teenage years were in the 1980s. So I sort of think like from 16 to 24, my drinking wasn't probably anything out of the ordinary, really. I didn't drink much. I didn't need to. Sometimes I overdrank and I'd always be sick. I'd be the one that had my head in a bucket. I didn't have much money either, so I think two drinks would often be enough. But from my mid-20s, drinking alcohol became very important to me. This was in the early 1990s. So I had split up with my first husband and my mum had passed away in 1989. My sister would often say that I never grieved. I wasn't used to expressing my feelings, so I guess I suppressed them. I had a good upbringing. I was well looked after and cared for, but it didn't include being comfortable asking questions or showing my emotions. I never really felt I could go to my parents for anything serious. It was more that these were set expectations of me, you know, be a good girl, follow these rules, and you'll live a good life. I worked as a legal secretary in Melbourne in the city. And we had drinks at work every Friday night, and we'd often kick on afterwards. There was a pub out the back of work, and I ended up there most nights after work. The owner of the pub actually named a drink after me. You know, you think you've made it, but it's pretty, like, pathetic now when I look back. So it was called the Doona, Ask for the Doona, and you get vodka soda, lime with extra lime. So I liked it sweet. You know, I wasn't sort of – I liked the girly drinks, I guess.
Yeah.
So then I started a relationship with a married guy at work, if you can say that that's a relationship. And my life was all about meeting him after work, and we'd always drink together. I wasn't taking care of myself, so lots of risky behaviours. There was a lot of drink driving on my part. I was pretty lucky that I never hurt anyone or got caught. Then again, you know, that might have instigated something else, who knows. I was often hungover at work. I had a poor diet, smoked cigarettes, drank. I thought I was having fun. And I think I also saw it as experiencing independence for the first time in my life. So I come from a very controlled environment at home. Then I married quite young, and I couldn't do anything because my mum did everything for me. So I didn't know how to cook or anything. So he did a lot of that. And so I was kind of then looked after by him and never looked after myself. And this is really only on reflection, and this is really only even in preparation for having a chat today. You sort of start to look inwards more. But I think alcohol to me then equaled freedom. I wouldn't have realised that at the time. But, yeah, I thought, oh, yeah, this is what life's really about. So, yeah, I guess I fast forward a bit to 1998, and that's when I met and married my husband now, Shane. We had met through a mutual friend, and the night we got together I had drunk a lot. I think we both had. He's not a big drinker though. I was a bigger drinker out of both of us, and often my drinking probably led him to over-drinking as well. I had a friend that I met post getting sober, and Shane was driving us somewhere, and she said, oh, what was Donna like as a drinker? And I said, oh, I think I was a bit of a serial pest. And he said, oh, sometimes I would just get on it as well, just so I didn't have to put up with her. And I was sort of taken aback, and I was like, oh, and he's like, well, didn't you know? Like, it was totally obvious to him. And I appreciated him telling me, but I had no idea. So that I found that really interesting. So, yeah, I just think sort of over the years my drinking would be up and down depending on whatever was going on. But my drinking was mainly in a social setting. So I was a bit of like the party girl. I think maybe it allowed me to be someone that I didn't think I was, someone a bit more interesting, funny. You know, I made people laugh generally, not always. I've made some people cry. But, yeah, generally it was in a happy party sort of setting. Day drinking was particularly dangerous. and I would always be really smashed. So if we went to the races during the day, ladies' luncheons, boys kick on, yeah, there was no limiting drinks. It was just on. And especially if you paid money for, you know, lunch and drinks, you're getting your drinks.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in the last sort of 10 minutes you're getting – you know, leave the bottles or
as much
get
as
more,
you can.
Get yeah. 10 glasses. Like, yeah, we've got to get our money's worth. Nothing too unusual, I guess. Shane was always worried about me when I went out without him, and I see now it was for good reason. But if we'd had a fight before I went out, I'd get even more drunk. So whether I was sort of, you know, saying, I'll show you, you know, I'm my own person, So, yeah, there was a bit of that. And sometimes I'd come home and perhaps have a fight with him, but then I'd wake up, I wouldn't remember, and he'd be upset and want to talk about it. And it was very hard for me because I wouldn't have known exactly what went on. Mm. You know, you just wake up with that feeling, you know, that you've fucked up, but you're not quite sure how. Yeah. I hope it's okay, I swear.
Yes, yeah, fine.
A little bit of a potty mouth.
No, it's
fine. But I've sort of identified 2010 as a year from which drinking wine at home became a thing. And I think a lot of that is sort of just sort of cultural, I guess. You know, before that, I don't really remember having lots of wine in the house and stuff. Like we always had spirits, but they used to just sort of sit on in a little bar area, but it was more if people came around. Sort of like my parents had, yeah. I guess. Or, you know, they were gifts. Shane would always get given bottles of scotch and stuff, and they'd usually go off before you could even drink them anyway. But we moved states. We moved from Melbourne to Perth in 2010, and I sort of kind of remember that wine at home started being part of my life. So, you know, we've moved from a social setting to more domestic drinking, I guess. Mm. And the weather in Perth is so great. You feel like you're on holidays.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll go and get a bottle of wine. And then it's like, I remember the nearest bottle shop, you know, was part of a pub, and I wouldn't drive through, I'd walk through because it was just around the corner. And they'd always have a 2-for-1 deal. So I'd always come home with two, and that sounded like a lot. But it was like, well, it makes economic sense to buy two.
Mm.
And I remember they had this special where you would get do you call them koozies or stubby holders? But it was for, you know, two bottles of wine. And it was like wetsuit material. It was really, you know, cool. But so I kept getting free ones all the time. And I thought, well, I can't even use that many. And I used to give them presents. But, you know, I used to buy this wine quite a lot. So I kind of recall that when the wine started coming into things. Before that, it was a lot of, probably gin or vodka, spirits, some wine, lots of champagne. But I just think that, you know, the marketing and everything has turned for, you know, and it's so acceptable to have wine with your dinner at night. Mm-hmm. So that started happening. I wouldn't say I didn't drink every night. And up until just before I quit, I was sort of a Thursday to Saturday drinker at night. So I didn't have the glass of wine with preparing dinner. It wasn't a thing for me, whereas it is with a lot of people. It can be triggering. But alcohol always made me a bit off, and so I would never want to, like, be getting ready to go out and putting my makeup on with a glass of wine or whatever, because I wouldn't be able to concentrate. The same with the cooking. It was like a separate thing, mm. You know, and I – you know, dinner or going out, party or whatever. So I guess it could have always been worse. So leading up to when I quit, and I didn't mean to quit, I just felt awful. I was just tired all the time. I did all this other great stuff for myself. I'd always pack a salad for lunch. I had a good breakfast. I exercised every day. I did Pilates. I did all these things that had me stepping forward, and then I'd have a drink and I'd go like 4 steps back.
Yeah.
And as I got older, I was going back and forth and back and forth, and I was getting a lot of, I've probably got, you know, some inflammation in my body, or I would have had quite a bit back then, but I was having a niggly right shoulder. And I used to even joke down at the physio or the osteo, I've probably got gout. You know, like the gout's probably gone to my shoulder, you know, or the alcohol's sitting in my shoulder, and I would laugh about it. And look, since I've quit, you know, my body isn't perfect, but I don't get that same niggly pain anymore. So I think it was the boost just sitting there. But, yeah, I used to laugh about it, joke about it, saying that alcohol was my sixth food group and, you know, working in personal injury and especially in abuse law, how could I ever quit drinking? I never contemplated it. A lot of lawyers do drink a lot. You know, it came from, you know, from when I was younger as well. But, I guess there was just sort of any excuse. You've had a hard week, have a drink, a reward, or something great's happened, have a drink. You know,
yeah.
I probably don't need to tell you there's an excuse if you want one. And I probably didn't. It's not like I could say, oh, I was having five bottles a week. I don't think it was anything like that. I would get upset with my husband if I'd buy two bottles. Well, I would just want the one bottle for myself, but I'd have to share it with him. So then I'd have the backup bottle.
Mm.
And I'd be keeping my eye on him, thinking, what's he doing? Oh, no, there's not going to be enough for me. You know, it was always about that.
Yeah.
And, again, it's all on reflection. I didn't know this was happening at the time. He would often ask me, you know, the next morning, oh, are you hungover? I would never admit to a hangover. Never, never. You kill me. And I wouldn't say I had a hangover. I would just say I'm just tired, always just tired. Because the other thing was, I thought I was calling it alcohol insomnia, but I was waking up at all hours. It depended, and it was only after reading William Porter's Alcohol Explained that I realised it was 5 hours after my last drink. So if I went out lunch drinking, day drinking, and maybe had my last one at, you know, 8 or something, then I'd wake up and, you know, go to bed at 9 or something. I'd be waking up 5 hours after that because I couldn't work out why does it sometimes happen at 1, sometimes it's at 3, sometimes it's at 5 or 6 a.m. And it just always felt like a massive hand was just slapping me on the face and waking me up, and my heart would be beating crazy and I'd be like, oh, my God, oh, yeah, what did I do last night? You know, did I leave my contact lenses in again? You know, stuff like that. I was always leaving. I always thought I had a good night if I woke up and my contact lenses were still in my eyes and my eyes were kind of stuck together. I always thought, oh, what a great night. Or, you know, got bruises on you or what have you. It must have been a great night. So, yeah, the insomnia, I think that did it to me in the end. I just felt sluggish all the time, and anything good I did just didn't matter because then I drank. Back and forth, back and forth. And so we're at the start of the COVID lockdown. So I'd had a massive March 2020, and that's when things, you know, the toilet paper started disappearing off shelves and we're all like, what is going on here? I went back to Melbourne and that's the other thing. Every time I went back to Melbourne, it was like I was on tour, like on an alcohol tour. Like I had to catch up with people and be the party girl and, it was exhausting. And so I had two massive weekends there, one after another. I'd had a fall during one of them. I had the biggest bruise on my thigh. It was about as big as my hand. And I still feel it there. It's so weird. It was so bad. You know, it was just the start, and there were all these little things, I guess, just adding up to me feeling really crap. It's Easter 2020. I'd been working 4 days for quite some time. So my Friday was really Thursday, so that's when the drinking would start. And it was Easter. So I worked 4 days and I was so looking forward to having 4 days off. You know, I couldn't go anywhere because we were locked in, but just wanted to chill out. And I had a Zoom or a FaceTime with some friends in Melbourne and with Shane, or I don't know, we're playing trivia or something. And he ended up falling asleep. And then that call ended. And so we'd had one bottle of white, I think, and then I had a bottle of red, which I didn't really drink a lot of usually. And the next morning there's like a dribble in it. And so that was actually quite a lot for me to drink. And I remember, you know, he'd gone to bed because he'd fallen asleep. And I was searching on Netflix for something to watch, and I was just going from one thing to another. I probably wouldn't have taken anything in. And I went to bed, and, of course, I was very hungover the next day. And so that was a Sunday. So Monday, and then I'm back at work Tuesday. So Monday night I'm lying in bed and thinking, I feel worse now after Easter than I did before, when I was so looking forward to, you know, just re-energizing myself. And I haven't been anywhere, just been at home and drinking, like, you know, what's going on? So I now call it my Easter epiphany, because I had a light glow moment. I just thought, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, what can I do? I couldn't think of anything else other than maybe I could stop drinking, you know, for a while. And it was sort of alien and also like, oh, hallelujah. And so that's why I call it my Easter epiphany. So it was quite bizarre, but I thought, yeah, and I just thought I'd keep it on a lowdown for a while. But obviously I told my husband and mentioned it too. I just had a small workplace and I was still able to go into the office. So it was good. I still had the office and home separated. And, yeah, I just thought, oh, I'll just have a break. I think I thought that's all I needed, just have a little break and then go back to it. I'm not sure where I got that idea from. So that was the moment, I guess. So nothing major had happened. I don't think anything. I listened to other people's stories and it never seems to be, you know, anything major. It's just that one thing that's tipped you over where you've gone, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And also I thought, what's this COVID thing? It'll probably be over in 3 months and I won't get COVID or die from that, but I'll get heart disease and I'll put on 10 kilos because, you know, a lot of people were drinking more or ordering it more in. And it was an uncertain time. So you're like, oh, who cares? Could be dead soon, so let's just drink anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was an uncertain time, but I also thought that other people were the reason I drank. And so not having to be with people was just the best opportunity for me to have a go at it.
Yeah.
But again, I didn't think I was, you know, quitting forever.
So you went in with the intention to have a break and basically that just carried on. So you didn't.
Yeah, I'm still on that break.
Wow.
Yep, still on that break. So I guess I hadn't read anything, so I didn't know, you know, the saying sober curious, but I guess I was without knowing that's what I was.
Yeah.
So I always try and encourage people just to stay on the day they're on instead of going, oh, no, I've got a wedding in 3 months and I want to go on a holiday in, you know, next year. Don't do that. Just see how you go. And the 30-day challenges, you know, they sound good, but I think a lot of people, and I know a lot of people that have done it and they think they're awesome, they've done it, and they are, they're awesome for doing it, but they're hanging on until the first of that next month and then they're on it again. And it's not, doesn't give you a great indication of what alcohol-free lifestyle can be. I always say it's got to be at least like 3 months at least.
Yeah.
And give your body a chance to do what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, 100%
by itself.
Agree with that. Yeah, 100% agree with that. I notice that a lot, not only in my own drinking with dry Januaries, but when I see
on social media comments or in the news, people that say, well, I did 30 days and it didn't change. I didn't change me. And I think, well, no, because it's not going to 30 days.
Yeah. And you know, you're going to drink on the first. So whereas I didn't know where I was going.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew that I'd felt like crap and that I was feeling better. And my husband, like he's been so supportive. But he would say, oh, my God, your eyes are so brown. And I'm like, they've always been dark brown. What are you saying? But they must have been clearer. Or he'd say, your skin, looks great. Always giving me compliments. And they're not, like he was genuine, but I'd be like, oh, you're carrying on a bit, aren't you? And he's like, no, you look great. And like incidentally, he followed suit. I think he's 411 days behind me, but in that year or so, he drank maybe four times. Mm. And he's somebody who will not drink at home alone. He thinks people that do that have a problem because his father had a drinking problem, and that's just always been his experience and his opinion. So when he saw, like, I would drink here alone, not a problem in front of him. But yeah, he wouldn't drink alone and he couldn't go out because of COVID. So in the end he was like, why am I even bothering on the, you know, few occasions? So, he's alcohol free as well.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. It's so quite nice, isn't it? When you do it together as well. When you're in worlds.
I think he learnt a lot from me as well, because he said he's the only person that ever was, well, sort of spoke to me about his worries about me and my drinking, you know, over the years. And, of course, I'd be very defensive and in denial, and nothing eventuated from it. And I just thought he was trying to control me. But he said, I always just wanted you to drink less. So he didn't really understand about, you know, the challenges of trying to moderate for somebody like me. Yeah. So he's learnt a lot through me as well. It's good. I mean, I said from the start, this is my journey. You do what you want.
Mm-hmm.
You drink, don't drink, whatever, but I just want you to act normally. So just do whatever you want to do. But this is what I'm doing.
So you, going back to the break, you were going in with the break and you said that you didn't read anything or do anything special, or at least that's
not
my
beforehand.
Plan. Yeah.
No, so I quit and then... Yeah, by myself, I guess, initially. I just didn't drink. I quit smoking 20 years ago, and I quit that many times, it did my head in. And in the end, I'm like, I'm quitting for the last time because I can't keep doing it over and over. I said, it's like PMT times 300%. I turn into some weirdo monster and I can't control myself and I can't keep doing this over and over, because you get through the early stages and 3 weeks in, you're back on the cigarettes again. So I think I saw that the only way that I'd ever – fuck up again in my life was if I drank.
Mm.
So I just couldn't have one. I decided I can't have one, because then I'm not going to be clear-headed and I'll probably have two, three, and then it's all over.
Yeah.
So it probably wasn't till about 6 weeks in that I started searching on the internet and started getting a bit, I saw something that said, if you think you've got a drinking problem, you probably do have one.
Yeah.
And I also saw that the statistics were much, much, much higher for abstinence versus moderation.
Mm.
And with my experience with smoking, I just thought, I cannot fuck this up as long as I just never drink. And it's, I don't have to do anything. I just have to stop this one thing.
Yeah.
And so I guess I just pushed through. But at 6 weeks, I found Hello Sunday Morning. And then through their website, they lead you to the Daybreak app, which is, it's anonymous. I'm not sure if you know about it. I think it's free only for Australians now, but we all have a code name, and you can just look around if you like, or, you know, you can share a post or what have you. And I got so many tips from there. It was like, oh, my God, there's this other world out there. Yeah. And bit by bit, that world got bigger and bigger. Yeah. But it was like a secret world. So that's where I got recommended to read William Porter's Alcohol Explained. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that book, he saved my life, or gave me another chance at it. It just was no nonsense, just explained everything, how alcohol worked.
Yeah.
And then I realised that, oh, now I know where the insomnia is coming from. So, you know, a lot of my friends are like, they weren't really talking about any problems with sleeping, with drinking. But then a bit further down the track, when you're talking about menopause, and, oh, like, menopause gets blamed for everything, and I don't know that it's to be blamed for everything. I think there are other things as well, and including, you know, what you're putting in your mouth. Mm. So, yeah, I found that really interesting, and also it kind of lifted some shame, you know, from my past and things that I'd done that I wasn't proud of, that there's no way I would have done sober, no way. Mm. You know, there's I think some people think that when you're really drunk, what you're doing is what you really want to do, and that's not, I don't think that's quite true at all. It's almost the opposite. And so, yeah, it took away some of the shame, and it was sort of like, well, anything I've done in the past, that's done, but I can guarantee my future behaviour.
Yeah.
Because the only time I have ever fucked up in my whole life has been from drinking. You know, there's nothing else. It was always under the influence of alcohol, which I know I drank it. But yeah, I didn't have to keep doing this. And so, yeah, my biggest fear, I think, was other people. And I thought that other people made me drink, but to be truthful, you didn't need to twist my arm very hard to have a drink. I'd go out during the week with Shane to, say, a local club or pub or something, and he'd often just have Diet Coke because he didn't feel like a drink. I would always have a wine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless I was sick. If I was sick, I probably wouldn't go out at all. But, yeah, I didn't often knock back alcohol.
Mm. Yeah. Same. I think I was the same, actually. I think even when I wasn't that well, I'd still sometimes have a drink because I'm under a hot toddy or whatever it's called, you know, hot brandy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It'll make me feel better, but no, Terry, you don't need three.
Yeah, it's medicinal. Yeah, well, I think I was medicating for years, really. I still find it hard to talk about my feelings, but I'm trying to be better. But obviously, there was a lot of suppressing going on.
Mm.
So, yeah, I was loved. There's no doubt about that. But my mum, I think I remember her saying she loved me once, and that was when she knew she was dying, and it freaked me out. I'm like, why is she telling me she loves me? We didn't talk like that. My dad did, but my mum didn't. And yeah, I mean, I am who I am, but I think I probably found it hard to have big feelings like a lot of people. The alcohol's already there and it's part of my lifestyle. So I guess you turn to it without even realizing you're doing it.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I do think as well, those, well, I can only speak through my own experience, but I do relate to what you're saying about, you know, 70s, 80s, and I bet probably many decades before that you you are raised in a particular way to act in a particular way. And, and especially as a woman, you stand in line and you keep your head down and you be quiet. But also equally for men, you don't cry. Boys don't cry.
Exactly.
Don't cry.
Yeah.
So I think that we all have those from those decades. We all have those kind of ghosts from the past.
Oh, for sure.
And it does lead to, you know, and I think when it does lead to drinking, big drinking in a lot of cases. And when you stop drinking and then you realize that really you are that very young version of yourself emotionally that was never allowed to flourish or to learn how to cope or to get the kind of emotional tools that I think we're much better at now with now about having feelings wheels and, you know, labeling feelings. And I mean, when I stopped drinking, I literally didn't know how I felt most of the time. I just I felt quite binary. I was either happy or sad. I didn't know that there was lots of layers of what that sad might be. It might be shame or whatever. You know, I just didn't realize. And I think that's just because I started drinking at 14. For me, my story was it wasn't so much that I couldn't express myself emotionally, but I didn't know also how to do it. I don't think my mum knew how to do it because she would always just be happy or sad, and she drank. And so she would either be really happy or really angry. It was literally like two switches. And I think for me at 14, I just fell into drinking because that was the culture. We were all drinking at 14. And I sort of stunted that emotional growth. And unfortunately for me, I drank through all the things in my 20s, 30s, and I didn't know how to process anything at 41 when I stopped drinking. It took a long time. I feel a lot better now. We were talking about this, weren't we, before we came online, which is that you did a podcast a year ago. And that you feel very differently even now from a year ago. And I really relate to that because every year I always say on this show, I say a lot, every year it changes, or, you know, you change, or you go a bit deeper into yourself, or you learn.
Yes.
And it's fascinating. But it's also great as well. But it does take time, doesn't it, to get to know way.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
But yeah, it takes a while to, and it's not even it's not even undoing stuff. It's just letting, the real you come out.
Yeah.
I guess it takes a while, and it takes certain challenges to come up, and you get through them. And, you know, one of the things that really helped me early on too was, and it was, you know, the whole COVID thing was great for me, and it was horrible for many, many people, and so many people lost their lives. So I don't want to gloss over that. But I think you can have something and, yeah, I took it as an opportunity. It just clicked with me that because, you know, I can be disciplined, but, you know, I just wanted to do it on my own. I didn't want all that outside interference. But when we were allowed to go back out again, it was for sort of 2 hours at a time, and I thought, oh, this is ideal because I don't have to put up with any drunks because, you know, it's 2 hours to go out for dinner and then you can't even kick on, so you just go home. And I'm like, yeah, great. Except, you know, I thought, I'm putting makeup on, doing my hair, and then you're only out for 2 hours. But I would observe people, and I realised how many moderate drinkers I actually do know. So the first group of girls I went out with, I'm sitting there going, oh, there's six of them and they've ordered two bottles of wine. If I was drinking, there'd have to be a third, and I'd want that third one just all to myself. And they just sat on those two. That was it. Once they were gone, they were gone. And I was just astounded that they're not ordering more drinks.
Yeah.
What's going on? And I love going out with those girls. And sort of early on, I think one of them said to me, oh, you know, so were you an alcoholic? You know, so they felt comfortable enough to ask me questions because it was very alien to them. They could take it or leave it. They're not big drinkers, so they just didn't understand it. So I'm always happy to talk to people who are curious or just don't even understand.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, so jealous of you that you don't understand.
Yeah.
But I always, I always thought that I was the problem, not the alcohol. I think that's sort of society driven. We're conditioned to believe it's our fault if we can't handle our alcohol. You know, it goes from very funny to very sad very quickly. But, you know, if you ask somebody, can you have a block of chocolate in your house, in your pantry, can you have a block of chocolate there and just have two or three squares? And a lot often people will say, oh, no, I can't have it because I want it all. I'll have it all. And I'm like, yep, that's me with alcohol.
Yeah.
And no one gets sort of shamed or guilted into believing you're a moral failure if you eat that whole block of chocolate. We're a lot kinder to each other with other things. But alcohol and drugs, and let's face it, alcohol is a drug, so it should all just be drugs. But, we're not as kind or understanding. But then when you explain it to some people, they get it. It was only until I was, on my sober journey that I came to realise it was actually the alcohol.
Yeah, 100%.
Not me. If you drank like I did, you would, have an issue too. So,
yeah.
But, it took a while to develop and,
I think learning the science as well, you mentioned about the William Porter book, which is an excellent no-nonsense book. I think when you take the time to learn the science around alcohol and drinking, it does relieve some of that shame because you can clearly start to see that alcohol shuts parts of the brain down, shuts your cortex, which is your decision-making unit in your brain, and the more that you pour in, the more offline that part of your brain is going.
Yeah.
So how can you expect yourself to make good decisions when you're on your third glass, which is easy to do,
exactly,
right? Yeah. Easy to have three glasses of an evening or at a wedding or whatever you're doing, at a brunch, whatever you're doing, especially now the glasses are bigger and that, there's a lot of, I remember if I would get a proper shot of 125 mil, I think, of wine, I'd be like, are you joking?
Yeah, it's a thimble.
What is that? I suppose, I don't know, maybe 100 years ago or something, like that was the glass that you had. Maybe two glasses were just two of those. And
you
really got yourself to the point, either because you couldn't maybe afford it or just wasn't the done thing. I don't know, I wasn't around. Yeah. But you could understand why two small 125 mil glasses might be easier to put down and then switch to a cup of tea and a piece of cake. Having two 250 mil goblets of wine.
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost two-thirds of a bottle in two glasses.
Yeah, the glasses are like fish bowls, they're so big.
Exactly. And also that, like you said, that social conditioning. I mean, everyone went for a phase quite recently, since I've been sober anyway, so within the last 5 years, of buying these huge goblets for gin. You know, they're literally they're like fish,
they're huge.
You know, fish bowls. They are fish bowls. Yeah. And you have all the pink gins and all the gins with rosemary and all the ice and the juniper berries and it's just it just got very popular for a bit, the gin thing. I feel like that has slightly died down now, and Prosecco and wine is always, I think, at the top for everyone.
Yes.
It's so strong, isn't it? Prosecco and wine is so strong. That drink, moving from having a beer or two thing and then moving on to wine. I remember when I started drinking wine, like wine is a lot stronger. And then you have the glasses. And then you can see how you can just condition yourself to drink that kind of way and yes, for that to be really problematic. Like, it's always going to be. But I think, going back to a point, what I liked about what you said, and I feel the same way, is that I think when you go into this journey to begin with, it is that shame of something's wrong with me. Why can't I drink like everyone else? Why do I always go too far? Why do I do stupid things when I'm drinking? I hate myself. Very self-attacking. But then you realise, what else? I mean, in a way, I feel like, well, poor me. I didn't stand a chance, really, because I was emotionally leaning on alcohol for various things because I had no coping tools. And that's sad, really, when you think about it. And then the drinks are strong and the ciders are getting stronger and the boutique beers are getting stronger and the social conditioning is so ingrained that you're the strange one for not drinking. It's like, that's just what you do. And then you train yourself to do that. And then you keep making the mistakes. It's just, I find it easy to have compassion for myself now, you know?
Oh, yes.
It's not your fault, but it is responsibility. And I think that's right. We've both done. We realised it wasn't our fault that we got to that point, or we drank in that way, or we made those mistakes under the influence. But you can't know that, or you can't feel that shift starting to happen inside and then just keep going down that road where it's just not serving you. You have got to actually pull your big girl pants up and make a bit of a change and change the story.
Yeah. And I think I found the learning really motivating because, there are some things you can't unknow. and I think, I don't know if it's William Porter or Annie Grace, one of them likens alcohol to motor oil. And so I just started thinking, I wouldn't drink petrol, would I? I mean, or, pure poison, So I had to look at it as a poison, I had to get angry with it. And I did the same with the cigarettes. I got angry with the cigarette companies because, they sucked me in. And so did alcohol. I feel like I've escaped a cult because, it is just so popular. And it's just in our everyday vernacular. But I do feel like, and it takes time, but I feel like a warrior. Yeah, I'm a warrior. I'm like, I'm not a sheep anymore. And I've got people coming to me and asking for my advice. Perhaps they're looking at their drinking and they're sort of coming to me secretly or not secretly, but they're just, I'm obviously a safe place for people and I love that. And I'm happy to talk to anyone about it. And, I haven't had much grief because the real dedicated drinkers, they don't even want to go there. They don't say anything. It's like there's no comment at all.
Really?
And I thought I'd be the same too. I always thought non-drinkers were strange, and I felt sorry for them because, when they woke up, that's as good as they're going to feel all day, whereas, my day would always get better, wouldn't it? Because I was always, I was often hungover. I found it's strange. But, I too learned that once other people have one or two drinks around you, they don't care what you're not doing. They don't care what's in your glass. It's been interesting observing people, and I still, I enjoy it at times. Because I've learned so much, and it's not just about alcohol but about myself. And I've done a lot of self-development, and I think I was sober when I listened to my first podcast ever. And so, podcasts, that's opened up my world. There's so much free education out there. It's amazing. So sometimes something will come out of my mouth and I think, geez, that sounded really good. Like, but I've learned that from somewhere, but I sound very wise. And, I was the pisshead, the party girl, the, couldn't take me too seriously kind of girl.
Podcasts only came onto my radar when I stopped drinking. I didn't even know what that podcast app was on my phone.
I was like, where is it? What? It's the purple one.
I remember tapping into it, just thinking, what? Right, okay, what do we do here?
I had a whole new world.
Yeah.
I love them.
Now I just can't. I mean, I absorb so much of my content through podcasts, through in my ears when I'm out walking, around the house. I just have a real thirst for that. Yeah, like you said, free knowledge. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, so I've got a Zen den here at home. So we used to have two spare bedrooms, and it was before COVID. We decided to get rid of one because I'd hurt my back in 2018 and learned that I didn't have a good area to sort of stretch. And so we made one of the spare rooms into a Zen den. I picked that up from somewhere. And so, yeah, if I'm stretching in there, put on a podcast, learn something, clean the house, clean the pool, go for a walk. Or I used to travel into Sydney, which was a good hour, 20 minutes on the train one way. And so it's a great opportunity to learn. And then I would often use it on my clients too, who are all trauma affected. Had no sort of formal training, but, a lot of it's sort of common sense, I guess. But, it's great access, podcasts, free therapy. I love it.
Yeah.
And often I would listen to one and then they've got a guest on and then I'll go over to their podcast and so on and so on, and it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. I absolutely love it. I've learned about regulating nervous systems, about neuroscience, health.
I love neuroscience. I feel like I have become a nerd, and I love neuroscience. Who would have thought it? I hated all science at school.
Same.
I had no idea what was going on. I was the dumb girl.
It's exactly the same. And now I feel like, how am I not set up in life so that I could do a neuroscience degree? I'm not sure if I'm even capable, to be honest.
But just so interesting to learn.
I love it.
How it all works.
How it all works, how the brain works, how the body works. And I do think that, deepening that learning does help to strengthen that desire to look after your body. I think when you abused it for quite a lot of years or not prioritized it. And you were talking earlier about big alcohol, and I feel that same anger, but I also feel that anger now to big food as well. The seed oils and the chemicals and the just absolute crap in processed food. I know you say don't eat processed food, but it's actually really hard to be completely processed food free. I find as a mum of three children, and all they want is the packaged processed foods as well.
Yeah,
so that's a real challenge. But
that's hard.
Learning about processed versus ultra processed, and then thinking about my childhood and how I've eaten. I think I eat quite healthily now, but that's only come recently, really, that real awareness of what's in my food. And all those years, just my parents would have been buying food, or I would have been buying food, and you just like literally have no idea what the bloody hell is inside this food. You can't pronounce the ingredients list. And so I find that frustration about smoking, about alcohol, and about food as well. I just think, for goodness sake, we've all been hoodwinked, really, by these big corporations, and also the same with pharmaceuticals as well. Like, don't get me wrong, I know that some pharmaceuticals do save people's lives, and I'm not anti-medication at all. I think it's life-changing, but I also get frustrated when I read studies about how science is uncovering that there are healthier natural ways that we can help ourselves, but yet that is not as freely accessible because big pharma don't want us to get our hands on that, because then they so that sort of stuff like annoys me, really. But that's all for another day. But you have that awareness, right? You kind of, it's almost like an awakening, right? You wake up.
And it's slow. It's, it doesn't all happen, but Yeah, I remember sort of maybe 6 months in, there was stuff going on at work that I wasn't happy with, and all of a sudden I felt like I had anxiety for the first time in my life. And I'm blaming it on, you know, menopause. Oh, it must be menopause. I'm turning into wacko. And then it wasn't till maybe the next year I looked back and I went, no, big feelings. I didn't know what to do with them. I didn't know how to process them. Like you said, you're getting better at processing things, and so am I now. So if something really affects me, it might be a two-day turnaround instead of, you know, 2 weeks at that time, or even longer at that time, because initially I didn't even know what was going on. But, yeah, much more in tune to my body and, you know, listening to my gut, trusting my gut. You know, I'd question it, then I'd go back and go, no, you shouldn't, you should have just stick with your gut, because it's served you well since I've been sober.
Definitely. I find that as well with internal versus external validation as well. Oh, so I've spent my life as a drinker wanting external validation. That's kind of, for some reason, that's all I've been tuned into. And then not drinking has allowed me, through listening to my gut and trusting my gut and just, yeah, just being much more aware of how I'm feeling, what I'm feeling, and responding to those feelings as well. So if I have a feeling I don't really want to do this thing, but then I still do it, then I don't feel very good. But if I don't do it, I feel rewarded for not doing it, kind of thing. And I don't feel like I seek external validation at all. I know I can validate myself now, and that's hugely life-changing for me.
Yeah, it's very empowering. And yeah, I remember, like I said, embarking on it, I was worried about everyone else. And then at some point, you know, it must have been a few months in, I just thought, I don't care what, it's what I think that matters, not what other people think. And I've got a friend that he's 41 years sober, and I met him he was a client at one of my former jobs, and we've stayed in touch because we first connected. It was during COVID, and he would often say that he was, you know, sober for so long, and I said, oh, I'm just, you know, whatever I was, 13 months or something at the time. And so he said, when my matter is over, because I said, I'll miss you afterwards. He said, no, nope, we're going to be friends for life. This isn't a coincidence that you and I have connected. And I had a chat to him today, actually. But, yeah, he'll just ring out of the blue at some point. Something will make him think of me, and he'll get it on the phone. And, yeah, he's great. And he always says center of self is not self-centered. So, yeah, you've got to be center of self.
I love that. I've never heard that before. But I really get that. And I think that's important, because I know, especially when I work a lot with women, I coach a lot of women on mostly the early part of the journey of stopping drinking, get to that point where they do stop. And I'm such an I'm always advocating for center of self, but I don't call it that. I really like that. But basically, just allowing other women to give themselves permission to be important to themselves.
And especially, I mean, I'm not a mum, but I can see it's a lot with a lot of females. They put everyone else comes first, kind of thing. And, you know, they feel kind of selfish because they're just not used to it. But you have to practice. And, you know, they always say happy wife, happy life. So, you got to look after yourself. I mean, everyone should be looking after themselves. But, you know, I look back and I think, gee, some of the things that I say to myself, I would have locked myself up as a drinker, you know, real woo-woo sort of stuff. Like I'm my own best friend, you know, stuff like that I would have gawked at before. But Yeah, I feel good. Like when this friend, when I spoke to him today, he's like, how's it going? I said, it's great. I go, I haven't got a job, but it's awesome. Yeah. As long as I don't think about an income, I'm having a great time. I feel very mindful.
Yeah, that's nice. That's nice. Contentment. Mm. And you're happy. You're happy with
Yeah, it's the simple stuff. Yeah, I really like the simple stuff. And there's so much that we have that we don't realise. I can see more clearly now.
There's a song, isn't there? I can see clearly now.
I can't sing. I don't want to sing. There's no way. I'm tone deaf. Yes, it is a good song.
So thinking about your journey with sobriety, nearly 4.5 years, and each year is different. I really relate to that. I really get that. What would be your top three tips based on your experience for people getting or staying successfully sober?
Look, a big one is not to entertain moderation. It sort of indicates to me that somebody is still holding a value of alcohol, and perhaps they haven't got their mindset right. It's like the 30-day thing. You can hang on and white-knuckle it and get through it, but, you know, you've got an end date where you're going to have a drink on the first of the next month. I wasn't looking at it like, oh my God, poor me, I can't drink, I'm such a loser. I wasn't looking at it like that. I think if you can spiral down, you can also turn it around and spiral upwards. Just change your language and change your attitude, challenge accepted kind of thing. Moderation, it's a mirage. It's a mirage for people like us. And if you think you've got a problem, you probably have. Don't even entertain moderation. It's actually kinder to yourself not to entertain drinking. But one day at a time. Don't look too far ahead. My second one would be to educate yourself. And embrace alcohol-free. So immerse yourself in that sober world, because the drinking is getting flogged all the time. It's everywhere we go. So you've really got to try and counteract that by immersing yourself. I know some people who are not drinking or not drinking too much, but they don't have that. That's it. That's all they've done. So they don't have sort of the supports in place that I have. Like we said, there's lots of podcasts, there's lots of books that, also include audio books. There are forums, social media, apps, and educate yourself on what alcohol does, because, like I said before, I found this really motivating, and I can't unlearn or ignore what I know. It's just too powerful. And, through education you can learn to self-regulate your central nervous system and stock up on, like, your sober toolbox, things that help you re-regulate your nervous system. So for me it might be exercise. Exercise was big for me in the beginning, and I did lose some weight. That was a byproduct. I remember making a note saying at 6 weeks I lost my tummy apron. and I was waiting for it to come back. It was so funny. I'm like, oh, it'll be back tomorrow. And then, it didn't. But I was doing a lot of exercise because I was edgy. Mm-hmm. I couldn't sit still. I worked during the day. That was okay at a workplace, and then came home. But come after dinner, sitting on the couch watching TV, I was not happy with that. I had lots of baths. And my husband, he didn't know this, he's a bit of a sweet tooth. And so he's a bit of a snacker to my drinking. And so I would hide some chocolate in the bathroom so that I would have just a little bit that I could have with a bath. But I had a bath nearly every night, and he'd go, gee, you're in the bath again? You're in the bath again. But I was also having a little bit of chocolate, and so when he hears this, he'll realise. But, you know, life, you have to in the early stages, and it's not that he asked, do you have chocolate? I just never told him, so it's not really a lie. But, you know, I lied to people. You know, it was COVID lockdown, and all of a sudden, like, I've lived interstate from my hometown for a long time, but no one ever wanted to FaceTime me then. But then we were all in lockdown, they wanted to do it. And I did a few, but I actually didn't like them. Mm-hmm. And everyone was drinking on them as well.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I would lie and say, oh, no, I can't do it. And I remember, like, one close friend, she said, oh, what, are you going to the pub? Like, because they weren't open. And I said, oh, no, somebody else has already booked me for that time. And so I'd lie, because I think you got to protect yourself in the beginning.
Yeah.
And that's okay, because, you know, there's a bigger payback for it. And they're just little things. They're not massive lies. Like I said, I've done a lot worse as a drunk person. Yeah. So, yeah, sometimes, you know, I think there might have been a work thing that I was a little bit funny about, and so I didn't go. But a lot of the time I did go, and I found that when I did one event, it made me stronger for the next time.
Yeah.
Like, I came home after the first dinner with these girls, and my husband's like, are you sure you weren't drinking? Because I was like, blah, 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 you know, and I was saying how awesome it was, and I was like this, and he goes, it's like you're drunk. And I said, no, I think this is who I am. And I always was. It was just that I was always drinking as well, so you just assumed it was the alcohol, but it was me.
Yeah.
Just over the top, I guess. So, yeah, sometimes he'd still think I was drunk. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, every time you go to an event and you succeed, you wake up and you think you're awesome, and you're ready for the next time, and you are building your sober muscle, as they say, bit by bit. But if you just lock yourself away for too long, it might not be as good. So I think, yeah, do it in dribbles, but do what you're comfortable with. You know, you're on your own journey. You know, you should just do your own thing. Again, shouldn't be worried about everyone else.
Yeah.
So I don't know, that was two, but that sounds like a long two. But my third one is community engagement, find your tribe. So as I said earlier, I've got my anonymous app support, Daybreak, and early on that was amazing. But I'm still on it quite regularly now, and more what I think more giving back. But sometimes I'll post something challenging for me. And the support you get is really, really good.
Yeah.
No one's judgy. I find no one is. I also have a group of local sober ladies that we get together. Some have struggled and back and forward, and I feel for them, but some of them have said that I'm inspiring, and I'm like, gee, that's unusual for me to be told that. So it is funny how people that have only met me sober see me. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, because they already know that version of you.
Yeah, not knowing my previous shenanigans. Yeah. So, but I find, like, I've had two new jobs since I got sober. And, yeah, I found people, they're pretty good. I mean, a lot of them are focused on alcohol, especially with work and stuff, but they're a lot more open to it. Things are changing. But, again, I'm just doing me. So, yeah, like I said, I've got a sober mentor of, you know, he's 41 years sober, and he's great as well. But I always, whoever I'm talking to, I choose my audience wisely, I guess. You know, I talk to certain people about certain things.
Yeah.
And, you know, early on, I would get a bit angry and think everyone needs to know that alcohol's poison. And no, they don't actually. And it's not my job to tell them either. But, you know, you've got this information and you want to share it, but you share it with the right people.
Yes.
People who want to hear it, people who are going to get something out of it. But you do go through your stages, so.
Yeah, I think we all would get a bit guilty of that, that over-enthusiasm for not.
Yeah, doing. Yeah. But then you think, you know what, I can only try and save myself. I can't, yeah. You can help, but you can't do it for other people.
No, you definitely can't. Yeah, that is very true. And so if you're open for us to follow your journey or connect with you, where can we find you?
Oh, yeah, look, I'm all over Facebook because I'm old, and apparently old people like Facebook. So it's Donna Bennett, Bennett. I've probably got a funny face on there at the moment. I post stuff about sobriety sometimes, not a lot.
Yeah.
So as long as you like the beach and dogs, that's a lot of what I post, I guess. And my Instagram is Duna67, but again, it automatically goes over to Instagram, but I'm not, like I said, I'm a bit too old for Insta apparently, but
yeah, you're too old for Insta, like I'm too old for TikTok. It's that sort of thing, isn't it?
Oh, and TikTok. Oh, gosh, yeah. Look.
Yeah, I just can't be bothered to get into that world. I have tried it, but it's too bombarding for my little brain. I can't get into it. And so
I like Facebook because of the story kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, Instagram is more just photos. And I love my photos, but I like a story and I like the memories pop up and things like that. So
yeah. No, it's and also on Facebook has a lot of really good free sober groups as well, which is awesome.
Oh yeah. Well, that's how I found the girls that we have our group. There used to be a group called Untoxicated. And just before it got shut down, there was a few of us trying to work out. We were in the same kind of area. And so we found each other. And one day I got a messenger message off a girl that was traveling around Australia, but was originally from Sydney, and remembered my name. And so she's still traveling. So we're like sober pen pals. I've never met her, but I tell her everything that's going on in my life. Like, she knows me really well and I've never met her.
I love that.
And so, hi, Tammy. Hi, Tammy.
Oh, hi, Tammy. I think you can make some really lovely connections, actually. I'm really close
to a girl
on Instagram that is sober a week. So she got sober a week before I did, same amount of years. And we have built our relationship really slowly from the beginning, but in the last couple of years we just got so close, and we have met up twice. We do something for our soberversary now in the same week.
So oh, lovely.
Our day. And I'm obviously, we're on WhatsApp, we're audioing each other all the time. She gets to know parts of me that not very many other people do, because we're really open. We've both been on the journey, and we're also both ADHD, so I think there's that thing where we're on a similar just kind of wavelength. And yeah, it's just, I think it's lovely when you make those sober connections. I do think
That's great. I was always a really good pen pal as a kid, you know, getting back to what did you do, what did you like doing when you're a kid, and I'd be great at writing letters and stuff, and so yeah, I think I'm just, yeah, I try to keep in touch with people now, but yeah, or some friendships that, and there's one in particular, a girl in Melbourne that we were always friends, but since I've been sober, we're a lot more connected. She's not sober, but she's not a drinker.
Yeah.
So she might have a drink, and sometimes she'll go, oh, Don's thought of you last night. They had an alcohol-free, you know, cocktail in a, you know, at the bar, and I thought of you, and I tried it, and it was pretty good. And because she doesn't always feel like, she hardly feels like drinking. I think a lot of people that are in that boat just do it for the other person that they're with. Yeah. I better have a drink with them.
Yeah.
They don't really want it. And there's so many great tasting alcohol-free drinks now. And everywhere I go, I will always say, have you got any interesting alcohol-free drinks?
Yeah.
And they'll go, oh, you know, if they say soft drink and juice, I'll go, yeah, look, I think you need to be a little bit more, you know, upmarket. Even our supermarkets have more interesting offerings. So I always sort of say it in a bit of a joking way. But, yeah, tides are turning. Yeah. So there's a lot more out there now. It's a good time to be sober, people.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And on that note, we're going to wrap up today. And it's been so lovely hearing your story. Thank you so much for sharing it with me and with my audience, and also for you staying up. I mean, what time is it now? It's got to be.
It's nearly 10:15. Wow.
I'm going to let you go off to bed.
Thanks, Terry. It's lovely meeting you, and thank you for having me. And, yeah, it's been a pleasure having a chat.
Yeah, it really has. And thank you to everybody else. Until next time, goodbye.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you're interested in being a guest, please contact me directly on Instagram by sending a message to @sassysobermum. You can also find helpful tools and resources on my website, sassysobermum.com. If you enjoyed the podcast and you want to spread the love, please like, share, and rate the podcast. I really look forward to next time. See you then.